Yeah, actually, that's the title that Alberto gave to me. The real title is Whatever You Wanted to Know About Gravitational, about Merging Binaries from Gravitational Wave Observations That You Never Dared to Ask. But I guess it was too long. So I had to say that I'm the figurehead here. This is work by several people. And especially, I want to acknowledge Davide Gerosa, who used to be my student, is now a faculty in Birmingham, and Case Wong, my PhD student at JHU right now. They're amazing. And also, Vishal Baibab is my other student, and a bunch of people that are listed there, and many other people that I forgot to list. And so, let me explain how I want to organize this discussion today. There's going to be several topics that I will talk about. I'll start by saying something that pretty much everyone in this room knows, what happened in 01 and 02. I don't know anything about what happened in 03, except what is public.
Except and for publishing a paper about a peaceful atmosphere.
You can publish papers about things. And then I will talk about, so the real goal of the talk is to discuss what we can learn from the various observables that we have already measured and from the ones that we hope to measure in the near future. In particular, I will focus on spins. I will expand on the discussion by Chris from the other day. And in particular, I will focus on spin alignment and the spin alignment in field binaries and compare it with the lack of spin alignment in binaries formed dynamically. Then I will turn to a discussion on multiband gravitational wave astronomy, which is what Alberto cares about very much. And I will talk about that. And
people ask about that.
So I'll say something about multiband gravitational wave astronomy. It's actually something I'm also very passionate about. And I will talk about what we could learn, various ways that we could detect multiband binaries, the role of eccentricity in telling apart models of black hole formation. And I will discuss at the end a recent paper by Chris Moore, Davide Gerosa, and Antoine Klein on possible issues in detecting these things and why it may be something that is possibly not achievable with LISA. And that will lead me into a brief discussion on mid-band detectors. And finally, I'll talk about something we worked on with Davide, and Dan also worked on it with Maya Fischbach, which is the idea that maybe the black hole mergers that we see in LIGO are so massive because they were not formed from stellar collapse, but they come from a previous generation of mergers. And I will talk about signatures of these multiple generation mergers in gravitational waves. And in particular, we'll talk about something that we put out just a few days ago with Davide on how we could turn the tables around. And if we see a black hole that is very massive, how we could possibly constrain the escape velocity of the astrophysical environment that produced these black holes.
Are you going to keep us for 2 weeks here?
Yes. I'll keep you hostage.
Just one subject.
We should have a cage match. just to start, I want to give you a couple of numbers that I think are useful. So keep in mind that LIGO ideally suited to the merger of black holes that are of the order of 100 solar masses or higher. And what I'm showing you here are noise curves that you all know. And this number down here is the ring down frequency of the black hole that is formed from the merger of two equal mass black holes scaled by the total mass of the remnant. And what you see is that the bucket of the LIGO noise curve is at 10 to the 2 hertz or maybe higher. And that corresponds to black holes of masses of 100 solar masses or higher. And we haven't seen anything like that yet.
So okay. Is that for spin of 0.7?
That's for a spin of 0.7, total mass M, to equal mass black holes merging.
So 250 solar masses, each of which are formed by dynamical processes, they have a spin of 0.7.
So this is, no, this is, so you take two black holes of 50 solar masses, right. You form a final black hole of 100 solar masses, what is the ring down frequency? Okay. Yeah.
So the spin is 0.7 if you don't assume any spin for
right.
The black hole prior to
right.
Okay.
Yes. And the second thing that I want you to notice is also that the scaling with the total mass goes like m to the 3 over 2. So again, we should see heavy guys, okay? And if we don't, it's because maybe they are not being made. And of course, you can also scale this to Lisa, but I'm not going to talk about massive black holes very much in this talk. The second thing that I want to point out is that since we're here for a couple of weeks, there's something going on in Europe that is called the Voyage 2050 call, which is the idea of thinking about possible things that we could do if we had a nearly infinite amount of money after this. And so I think this is a good venue to start throwing ideas around on what we could do if we had a mid-band detector or a detector in between PTAs and LISA, and what kind of astrophysics we could do, and so on. So for that purpose, I'm putting up this other set of noise curves that comes from a paper on testing GR by Kent Yagi, one of his students. And what you see here are the advanced LIGO noise curve in yellow, Cosmic Explorer down here, LISA, the Chinese LISA, Tianjin, and then you see a couple of mid-band detectors, BDSIGO and DSIGO, and I'll get back to this, and just keep in mind that, once again, if you have a black hole like GW15-914 and you want to see the spiral before it merges in the LIGO band, having a mid-band detector is going to be great. Besides, there are other ideas that I will discuss later based on atom interferometry for going to the mid-band, and I will also discuss that a little bit. So, the catalog. You all know these are the systems that we have seen. I just want to point out a few things here. The rates for black hole binaries have been constrained very well. They depend on the assumption that you make on the shape of the mass function of black holes, if you like. But once you have made an assumption, the width of these Gaussians is pretty narrow, and the rate could be 20, could be 60, but it's constrained to a pretty small range already from O1 and O2. Neutron star, as you can see, the width of the rates is much larger, but once again, we know pretty much where that number lies from the very first LIGO observation, and then these numbers are probably going to get tighter after O3. For neutron star black hole, of course, we haven't seen any, so we only have upper limits on the rates that are shown here as a function of the mass of the black hole. And another thing that is, I think, very interesting that came out of the first LIGO detections is some hint that the merger rate might be evolving with redshift, and it seems to be growing at low redshifts, and the question is, does it have a peak around Z=2, where the peak of the star formation rate is? And if so, can we access that peak sooner or later as the detectors improve? Second thing, masses. You all know everything about this, so once again, I'm not going to spend very much time on it. But what I want to point out is that so far, the one really special guy that has been published by the LIGO Virgo collaboration is this 170729, and especially in many ways because the mass is at the edge of the perinstability, pulsational perinstability gap, if you believe that such a thing exists. And it's the farthest system that has been observed so far, and it also happens to be the one with the largest spin. So that could be a selection effect, because we know that black holes with large spins tend to emit more gravitational waves. It could be, people tell me, the fact that glitches tend to be look more like spinning black holes. Could be many things, but it's something to think about. So this is again from the LIGO papers, and it shows you under different assumptions for the shape of the mass function that there seem to be no black holes with mass larger than about, depends on what you believe, 40, maybe 50 solar masses. And most black holes tend to be comparable mass, okay? And so there's this plot also that comes from the LIGO Astro paper that conjectures that maybe the absence of black holes in that region is due to the pulsational perinstability. And so maybe we are not able to produce black holes pre-merger that have a mass between 50 and 130 solar masses. Okay, that's everything I want to say about the masses, and it's just a reminder. Now, let me go into spins. why do I care about spin so much? Now I want to pull out something that maybe some of you have already heard, but this comes from Ryan Lang and Scott Hughes, and I think hearing it says much more than words. So I will play the sound from two black holes in the LISA band rescaled to be audible with mass ratio 1/3 when they do not spin. Sorry. So that's the kind of thing that we have heard by having effective spins that are very close to zero. But if you do hear precession, these are spinning black holes with the same mass ratio. Okay. I'm pretty sure you could hear the second harmonic in there. And it should be clear that there's a lot more information in any signal that is precessing. And this is something we should mine. I'm really looking forward to a signal besides the Boxing Day event, which had some mild evidence for precession, for which these signatures are audible in the gravitational wave band. So far, everything looks, unfortunately, kind of boring. Most of the effective spins are very close to zero. There is this one guy here that I already talked about, and then there's the Boxing Day event. There's some marginal evidence for at least one of the two black holes being spinning. And I'm sure all of you have seen this plot, and this plot has been used to say, well, probably all of the LIGO black holes are non-spinning. I can safely say that that's not true, okay? So what this plot really says is that chi effective, which was defined by Chris the other day, I put it on the board again, is close to being zero if you believe in the prior. And the prior assumes complete ignorance. So it assumes that there's an isotropic distribution of spins with a uniform distribution in the spin magnitude. And what you get if you assume that is a distribution that looks dangerously like the posterior. So to me, what this says is that the data are very uninformative.
The thing is, if I may interrupt, that prior actually implies it favors dynamical channel when you expect kind of random, not totally random, because a lot of dynamical systems actually come from primordial binaries, but it favors dynamical evolution.
And I agree with Chris, and in fact, the Princeton group tried to go a different way and use different priors, and they get spins that seem to be larger when they use different priors. So just be very careful.
It's totally fine as long as we know this.
Is there a LIGO that tried different priors? Like, what if you just assume that they're all chi-effective is longer than positive?
Yeah, you shift chi-effective measurement pretty much. Richard O'Shaughnessy has done this for some of my papers. And you just shift it where you want them.
You can't change it to be informative.
So, do you actually get some of those that are consistent with zero to shift over to having a chi effective?
Not convincingly.
But
the data is not very important. Yeah, so that's the bottom line. Yeah. Yeah. Prior in, prior out.
If you have a prior which prefers, to the right, you'll get more support to the right.
The deal that people are making about most of the LIGO black holes seem to not be spinning is just wrong.
It is biased by the prime.
Yes.
And there are several papers that go in.
You could ask, for example, could they all be maximally spinning in a lot? And there's not a lot. That gets to be a little hard, though, again, it's not 100%. It's all weak. But it's hard to account for what's been observed if they're all
maximally spinning units.
But that's already interesting.
On astrophysical grounds, you wouldn't expect, unless they spun up by some means, but you wouldn't expect those black holes to be involved in mergers. But now, like the discussion we had last week about information, it's not unreasonable to expect black holes that spin to 0.2, 0.3, 0.4 when they form. Now, that would be an interesting number to measure. You could say that there
look at the confidence levels on theirs, they can easily go up to 0.2.
Right, so then the ratio.
But those confidence levels are also generated with the assumption of the astronomic prime.
So the bias is still in that form. With the bias to small spins, they allow for spins of
the data, the measurement of
I'll never make it
spins from the data is not very informative.
Well, let me just phrase it another way. So I don't like to label this, but let's suppose your favorite stellar evolution theorist said, my model says that black holes spin, their Born spins are 0.5 plus or minus a bit. So you put that into a prior, will these data be consistent with 0.5? So they're all aligned, so kind of vectors.
Yes. I'll get to it. So there, yes. So let me go through a couple of the arguments that have been made in the literature. This is from a paper by the Northwestern group at the time, Carl Rodriguez and others. And so their question was, if we had a single measurement of negative chi effective, initially that was believed to be 17.0104. If you look at the latest 0102 catalog papers, evidence for chi effective being negative is mostly gone. But let's suppose that we have. So one question I've been asked over and over by several people, in particular Cole over dinner, is what would make you give up on a particular formation channel if you were to observe a certain signature in gravitational waves? So this was one of the first numbers that people claimed could convincingly rule out one formation scenario compared to another. Okay, so let me discuss a little bit this. The idea was, if I measure a chi effective that is negative, it's extremely hard to make a black hole with negative chi effective in field formation. I will argue that, in fact, this is not the case, okay? So the argument goes like this. Let's suppose that neutron stars are have kick velocities that are distributed according to the Hobbes et al. Observational data, like a Maxwellian centered around 265 kilometers per second. Then let's ask the question, let's take black holes that are formed dynamically, and let's see what kind of spin misalignment results from dynamical formation. That is easy, because you assume that everything is completely random. And then what you find is that the probability of having a misalignment between L and the total spin goes like sine theta over 2. Okay, that's just isotropy. Notice that they use theta LS, which is not chi effective. That's L dot S, where S is the total spin. Okay, so it's something different. But they argue, well, if they are formed isotropically, then preferentially, this should be picked around 90 degrees, and then you will have a 90 percentile distribution that is shown by these dashed and dashed dotted lines and so on. So this is what you will get from dynamical formation. And then they say, let's take different assumptions on what the kicks could do for black holes by rescaling what we know about neutron stars. So you can say that the black holes are reduced by some amount of fallback material that you parameterize by a number that goes from 0 to 1. You could say that the kicks are reduced by some conservation of momentum argument, let's say by the ratio of the masses of the black hole and the neutron star. Or you could assume, if you really want to kick the black holes as much as you can, that the kick distribution of black holes is the same as for neutron stars. And then you get these things here. And the argument is, for something as massive as GW150914 or 17.0104, because the mass range is about the same, it's very hard to get something that is compatible with chi effective being negative. Okay? All right, so that's the argument. However, this assumes that you start with aligned spins, you kick the black holes somehow, then you don't do anything with the post-Newtonian dynamics of these black holes after they get kicked, and I will argue that things are actually much more complicated than that, and let me explain how they are more complicated than that.
Emmanuel,
yes?
What's the magnitude of the initial spins? Do they have some assumption?
I forgot what they take. Does someone remember if they take them uniform from 0 to 1 maybe, but I should open up the paper. I read it a long time ago and I don't remember. It's either maximal or uniform from 0 to 1. They probably assume something like that. Okay, now, So let me explain a couple of things about post-Newtonian dynamics. This is a one-slide summary of something that is pretty complicated, but I'll try to make it as simple as possible. So imagine that you have the orbital angular momentum of the binary pointing along the z direction, and you want to characterize the position of spin 1 and spin 2 relative to the orbital angular momentum of the binary. You can always choose your reference frame so that S1 and L are in the XZ plane, okay? And then S2 is some other vector that can precess around L any way you want, all right? So there will be two angles, theta 1 and theta 2, that correspond to a scalar product between S1 and L and S2 and L. And then another angle that is important in characterizing the dynamics is the angle delta phi made by the projection of S1 and S2 in the direction orthogonal to L, or if you like, on the orbital plane. So let me call that angle delta phi, all right? So if delta phi is equal to 0, it means that S1 and S2 are both on the same side of L. If delta phi is equal to pi, it means that S1 and S2 are on opposite sides of L. But in both cases, they are coplanar. They are in the XZ plane, all right? So Jeremy Schnittman, some years ago, discovered that these configurations are, not quite, but attractors of the dynamics in some way, okay? And they correspond to resonances, he called them. So what happens is very interesting. What happens is that if you start with a black hole binary for which theta 1 is smaller than theta 2, so say theta 1 is the more massive guy, initially theta 1 is more aligned with L than theta 2, then at the end of the evolution of the binary in vacuum, delta phi tends to 0. The two spins tend to be on the same side, and they tend to be aligned with each other. Theta 1, 2 tends to 0. Vice versa, if theta 1 is larger than theta 2, you tend to have preferentially the opposite configuration where the spins are on opposite sides of L. Okay. So we ask the question, okay, this is very interesting. Can we observe it in LIGO? Now, let me tell you my simple-minded general relativist version of how a field binary forms, okay? A field binary forms, to me, it forms like this. You start with two stars. So let's assume, like most people assume, that the two stars are spins that are aligned with the orbital angular momentum. Look at my hands and don't look at the mess because it's easier. So you have star 1, more massive, star 2, less massive. Star 1 evolves, expands, fills its Roche lobe, starts transferring mass to star 2. Okay? Now, mass transfer can be efficient or it may not be efficient. Depending on how efficient mass transfer is, this star that initially was the less massive may end up producing the more massive black hole, if you transfer a lot of mass. Or not, we don't know that, okay? So mass transfer can swap the roles of theta 1 and theta 2 at the end of the story, depending on whether it's efficient or not. Remember this. So okay, star 1 swells up, transfers mass, eventually collapses, forms a black hole. When the star collapses to form a black hole, it gets a kick. Now, if the kick is too large, the binary gets disrupted, it never merges in LIGO. If the kick is small enough, the binary stays bound. And now, since you have started with aligned spins, you have a black hole over here, and the binary stays bound, orbital angular momentum is still pointing in the direction of my head, but now theta 1 and theta 2 are both equal and misaligned with L, okay? Now, this is a big star, this is a black hole. Now there's tidal effects that may or may not align the star.
Emmanuel, with, why, yes. Why does it have its spin actually changed in direction?
Because I started with both of them being aligned. Whatever direction I kick this guy, if he stays bound. You see that?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So now, black hole 1, star 2. Star 2 is puffy, it starts swelling up, eventually will go boom and through supernova form a black hole. Now, it could or could not realign with the orbital angular momentum if there are tidal effects. Okay, so depending on the strength of tidal alignment, I can produce a misalignment between theta 1 and theta 2. If there are no tides to align this star, both spins will stay comparable in magnitude. Theta 1 will stay very close to theta 2, and so all of these interesting dynamics that I was talking about will never happen. But let's suppose that this star aligns a little bit. Okay, now it goes boom. But if I want to form a binary that forms in LIGO, there must be some common envelope that shrinks the binary. It could happen after the first supernova, or it could happen at the very beginning. I don't know when it happens. By the time the second star goes boom, the binary is much more tight. And so the second kick will misalign less than the first kick, typically, right? So now I have theta 1 and theta 2 that are misaligned by some amount. And then I do a post-Newtonian evolution of following these rules, and I end up locking preferentially into delta phi equals 0 or delta phi equal pi, depending on two key things. The two key things are, were the tides efficient, or was mass transfer enough to swap the mass ratios? So I would expect that if nothing happened, I will get free precession. Nothing ever locks. But if one of these two things happens, most of the binaries that I observe in LIGO at the end should have delta phi close to 0 or delta phi close to pi. And by measuring the ratio of binaries that I observe in the three different delta phi groups, I can tell how many of those underwent mass transfer, how many of those were aligned by tides, and so on. So that's the key idea.
So this was yes. There's one thing that I think we all miss in calculation, and I just learned a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. When you want to align your tide, you also spin up a black hole.
Yes.
Or a star, I mean, that will produce a black hole. So that will put your chi effective up.
That's good for us. Yeah. Because if you spin them up, the post-Newtonian effects that produce these are stronger.
Yeah, but not necessarily so good when you compare with light with data.
Okay, yeah. Sure, yes. Yeah.
So you might be about to say this, but when you are to the stage where you have two black holes in whatever spin and orbit configuration, so no more mass transfer or anything, does the subsequent evolution, including gravitational radiation, conserve chi effective? Once you're there, chi effective is safe.
Chi effective is conserved. Chi effective is a very good number to measure. This was discovered by Etienne Racine in a paper in 2004 where he didn't call it chi effective. It was first proposed by Damore. And then we rediscovered it with my guest and by doing evolutions and finding that they were aligning along a special direction. Then we went back to the papers by Etienne, and we said, well, I knew about the paper by Damore, but I didn't realize that Etienne had actually proved it, that these guys conserved the 2pn. So it's a very good number to measure. So now, I didn't say anything about spin magnitude so far. And all of the picture that I've shown here was done in a special case in a paper in 2013. It was the first paper by Davide. Over the past, 6 years, I tormented Davide until he did the following thing. He took all of the simulations that Chris was talking about the other day, and in the meanwhile, we found a very efficient way of evolving the spins using a precession average thing that you don't want to hear about. It's a lot of GR. But the key is that now we can evolve millions of binaries in seconds because we precession average. And so we can do statistical distributions of these things. So we did the following thing. We said, we don't know what the spin magnitude is, because we had a very long discussion last week, and we don't know what it is. Let's assume that it's uniform between 0 and 1. Let's assume that the spins are maximal just to maximize effects. Or let's take what Chris suggested. Let's take these simulations that seem to suggest that the spins will decrease with the total mass of the binary.
That was the Geneva model that I would disfavor. So we have new models right now.
Okay. So what we do is we take some average of the general trend, very large error bars, and these triangles are let's Monte Carlo the hell out of it. So we don't know what happens in between those 90% confidence levels. So we call that collapse. Okay, just remember, collapse means spin decreases with mass. And then because we don't know what to do about tidal alignment, let's assume that tidal alignment never works, no tides. Tidal alignment is always efficient at aligning the second star, or we take some tidal alignment time scale from an astrophysics paper that estimates these things by Kushner et al. Then what we do is we take all of the binaries from Chris that have no spins, we put the spins on top with these prescriptions on the magnitude and the alignment, and then we evolve everything. We estimate whether these binaries are detectable by using some Lull waveforms. And one of the key elements in the simulations is the magnitude of the kick, because as I said at the beginning, kick produces very large alignments, but also it tends to disrupt the binaries. So in general, what you see is that if you look at the rates for any given model, here we fixed one just for sake of illustration, the rates go down dramatically as the kick magnitude increases, okay? So that's the general trend, whatever detector you take, LIGO, Voyager, third generation, Cosmic Explorer. And then what we find at the end is that the general picture that I was explaining before holds up when you take all of the binaries from Chris and you put these things in and you observe the bimodal distribution I was talking about. And what you get depends on which particular scenario in the Star Trek catalog we are looking at. So for example here, black hole one, black hole two, tide zone means that black hole one forms first and then black hole two forms, while in this case you have mass reversal, black hole two and black hole one form in the opposite order. And what you see is that you have the general story that I was talking about before. Now, this is the interesting plot that I wanted to get to. So once you have done all of this work on actual models and putting in everything that you can conceivably do to parameterize your ignorance, what is the distribution of chi effective that you get in the end? Now, look at the plot on the left, because it explains the breakdown of different formation scenarios on the overall rates. Here at the bottom, you see the general trend that I was talking about before. So the rates decrease with the magnitude of the kick. Up here, you see the different channels that contribute to the total rate in blue, broken down by different formation scenarios. For example, the blue line means black hole one goes boom, kick, common envelope shrinks the binary, black hole two goes boom. So that seems to be the channel that produces most binaries visible in LIGO, especially when the kicks are small. The second most favorable scenario that produces about 30% of the binaries is the one where you have mass reversal. Black hole two, common envelope, black hole one. Now look at this orange line. This orange line doesn't contribute anything when the sigma is small, and then it mysteriously becomes dominant when sigma is very large. That scenario corresponds to common envelope happening before both supernovae. So you shrink the binary first, then black hole one goes boom, then black hole two goes boom. That's a minority channel for the overall rate, but it ends up being favored when the kicks are very large because the binary stays bound because you have already shrunk the binary to begin with, okay? On the right, I showed the distribution of chi effective. So this is the complicated version of the story that Chris was telling you about a few days ago. So collapse, max, and uniform are the different scenarios for the spin magnitude. So max means that I take all spins to be maximal, and that, unsurprisingly, chi effective is very close to one. We can say
that's all initial spins maximal when evolving through the PN.
Right. So we can safely say that LIGO data are not compatible with this orange line. Okay, I give you that, sure. Then, collapse is the scenario that Chris was talking about mostly with some caveats the other time. And what you see is that you get a distribution that favors positive chi effective definitely. If you remember, he had a peak around 0.8. Yeah, that's more or less what he showed
you. The Geneva model, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But there is also a tail over here of events with negative chi effective. I will tell you what is in that tail. I will quantify that tail. Uniform is complete ignorance on the spin magnitude, and what you see is that you have a nice, you know, skewed distribution with a maximum around chi effective equals 0.5 and a very long tail. So how much is in that tail? Here it is. So how much is in the tail depends mostly on tides, on what you assume about tides. Collapse, uniform, and max, if you look at them, especially collapse and uniform, lie very close to each other. Max is pretty much disfavored, so we shouldn't even look at it. But collapse and uniform are very close to each other. And the bottom line here is that the probability that chi effective is negative depends on sigma. The larger sigma, the more you misalign. But it seems to be, depending on what you want to believe, anything between 3% and 10%. Now, we have seen 10 events. If one is negative chi effective, I'm not shocked. Okay? So that's the bottom line. Even if they were all, which I'm not arguing, even if they were all from the field, I would not be shocked if one in 10 had negative chi effective. I would not expect to see a distribution that is picked at chi effective equals zero. I'm not claiming that. I cannot do that with field formation.
But you cannot do that with a Geneva model, but you can do that with Mesa model, with Irish for dynamics.
If the spins are zero.
No, close, it's not zero.
Yeah.
Small.
Yes.
Small.
If the spins are small, everything is centered around.
I think the most pessimistic model that we have right now for natal black hole spins and still showing that you can get a negative spin for a given particular binary. Let's put it that way. And now we updated the models to shift our natal spin closer to smaller values with tireless fluid dynamics.
Yes, and we should repeat all of this if I convince David to do it again.
I would hope so, you know. Yeah.
So if you go to zero, then the fraction with chi effective less than zero is basically half, but they're all small.
No, not half. It's still
what we have. It's a little positive.
Well, it's okay, so the average would be 0.1, but so the tail will be larger on the negative side. So the fraction he's giving 5 to 10% will be less. Yes.
But
so
we're more consistent.
But yeah.
Let me give you two caveats also. The first is
caveats.
More caveats. I started by assuming that both stars are aligned with L, because that's what everybody does.
Mm-hmm. Russia is doing the best. I'm sorry, I need to correct you. I
was about to say that there's people go out there and try to measure the alignment of stars with the orbital angular momentum, and there's a whole project that is called Banana, for binaries are not always neatly aligned. That wins my best acronym of the day. And if you assume that they're not aligned, you get more misalignment, obviously. Number one. Second, what you can really say if you see single detections with chi effective negative is that dynamical formation would be favored if the spins were initially aligned, but banana, and black hole kicks are small. That's true. If kicks are small and all spins are initially aligned, this probability goes to zero. No question about that. Okay? All right. That's all I wanted to say. Now, what is really interesting is developing a more general hyperparameter formalism where you throw everything you have and you build families of models and you use machine learning, and that's a lot of exciting stuff that is going on. And when we have 20 events outside of LIGO, maybe we can play some interesting games. But okay.
So, comment on your statement that, you know, if the black holes were kicks were zero, we have about 16 estimates for black hole kicks in our galaxy. For two of them, the speeds are not zero. Kicks, natal kicks are not zero. So for some of them, for most of them, the estimates are consistent with zero, and it looks like the kicks are much smaller than for neutron stars, but at least for two, lower limit is about, you know, 1,500 kilometers per second.
Yeah.
So they could be kind of taken out of the table by electromagnetic observations.
That
are all zero. It's not consistent with electromagnetic data. All of those estimates are kind of, it's not measurements, estimates. Yeah, we have a lot of caveats as well.
Mm-hmm. So in your treatment of the tidal alignment, is that equilibrium tide or dynamical tide? Dynamical tie can be to misalignment because of the frequency.
We use Kushner, but.
So for you know, for.
Equilibrium tie, right?
I think so. Yes. We just put in a time scale and we say they align if the time it takes to go from the first to the second supernova is shorter than some tidal alignment.
This is a subject of interest,
yes,
in the context of planets,
yeah,
and obliquity that we observe.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many attempts to understand them. One of them is whether it could be due to dynamic.
So I can tell you this, that you should probably, I can put you in touch with Mike Kasdan because I know that he's been looking at this more carefully with one of his students. But that's all I can say. Okay. Okay, next. One of the things, so I discussed so far things that can be done with the binaries that we have seen in LIGO. But Lisa, I will argue next, if we had it flying already, could give you complementary information. It could target different populations of black hole binaries. And most importantly, it could give you hints on the eccentricity of these binaries, which is something that is very hard to measure in LIGO. So this is work done, again, with many people. The idea goes back to this guy over here. So he called me up excitedly one night, and he's like, oh my god, I just realized that if we had LISA, we would have seen GW15 or 914 in LISA already. And so then Alberto put out a paper where he said, okay, let's take that range of rates that I've shown in maybe the very first slide from LIGO, and let's try to estimate how many binaries would be detectable with SNR larger than 8, keep in mind that number, if I were observing for 10 years. And he came up with some numbers that are in the range 10 to 100. Great.
Well, this is great, one per year?
No, wait. Those are the numbers. So the 10 years is, that's the number of systems that will coalesce within 10 years when I observe them.
Ah, that's right.
And then the bottom, you know, the legend on the x-axis is for LISA for your observation. And mm-hmm. LISA.
Yeah. So the yellow ones do not coalesce within 10 years, and the blue ones do?
No, those are log flares.
The top, okay.
So the top panel are all systems with SNR at 8. The bottom panel are those systems that will also coalesce within 10 years.
So I'll get back to this because we have redone this analysis using the SPOPS models. But these were the initial estimates by Alberto, and I wanted to put them up.
But it pretty much means the main message is we get the same message. We expect very few events in the entire population of FLIGO detection, very few,
yeah,
to be detected by both instruments.
Yes. Yes.
Despite the fact how David presented it. I mean, he went so optimistic, but of course, when he presented that way, paper get published right away. Mm-hmm. But I'm an author on the paper. I don't see this as something really great thing. It's nice that we have a chance to see them,
yeah,
but it's a small number.
It's a small number.
Yeah.
Does third generation matter for this number, third generation?
No, not really.
You just get a lot higher than the problem is LISA. Yeah.
The problem is LISA, and that's why I will get to mid-band detectors later. Okay. What can you do with these binaries is in the original paper by Alberto. Basically, you can measure the coalescence time of these binaries to an accuracy of about 10 seconds. You can localize them in the sky to within about 1 square degree. So if they had an electromagnetic counterpart, but unfortunately they're stellar mass black holes, you could go after the electromagnetic counterpart. But unfortunately they are black hole. So I'll get back to this. Chirp mass you can measure very well. Mass ratio, okay. Now, keep in mind that then after Alberto came up with this paper, there was a paper by Alberto Vitale where he said, by Salvo Vitale, where he said, if we had LISA and LIGO now, how much better could we measure the spins, for example? But he took the advanced LIGO noise curve that we have now and the LISA noise curve, And of course, there's an error of perspective here, because by the time LISA flies, ground-based detectors are going to be much better than that. So you should really ask, what can I do by 2030 if I have some 3G scale detector network, maybe?
Everybody's a little bit over-optimistic having 3G in 2030. I mean, it's a big enterprise. I mean, you might have LIGO Plus, LIGO Plus Plus, but 2.5. You can 3G from scratch in 10 years. It's, I don't know.
It might be somewhere in between.
It's, I mean, it's I agree with Alberto on this, and you're gonna have A plus, but 3G when LISA flies? I mean, of course.
Einstein telescope or cosmic X.
So it will take 30 years to build this stuff, 20 years to build this stuff. So
yeah,
they can be contemporary, but it's not obvious.
Yeah, I'm on the US 3G team, so I should be optimistic, but I wouldn't bet against LISA flying first.
Don't you want LISA to fly 2030 and then these to be 2040 where you can see these?
Ah.
You want to see them in LISA 2030?
Yeah.
We'll have a deadline.
In fact, we better have a science run within this 10 second deadline.
Yeah, you can tell. In fact, you can go back to your archival data from 10 years earlier when your kids were taking data with LISA.
Your grandkids
can get more binaries out. That's exactly. I'll get to that. We wrote a paper on that, CPRM. Okay. So anyway, the point is, if I saw one of these binaries in a 3G detector, a GW50914 like binary will have a signal to noise ratio of 700. Now, signal to noise ratio of 700 means that you measure everything to an accuracy of 1 part in 10^3. How can LISA help you at all if it sees one of these guys with an SNR of 8, right? That's, it looks like maybe LISA cannot do very much for you, right? However, you can do a couple of things with LISA. First of all, if you see systems that merge on the ground, for example, very massive systems, and you only see the merger, you could only measure the total spin of the final black hole, say. But if you see the inspiral of the same system in LISA, then you could measure perhaps the spins of the two components. Because it's massive, remember. So if it's more massive, it will have more SNR in LISA. Second thing that you can do quite obviously is this. We put this in one of the Astro 2020 white papers. If you have a system with a total mass of about 600 solar masses, now don't ask me how you make these guys. but if you had one of these guys, then you could measure the total mass very well with ET, and you could measure with LISA the chirp mass, and then you will have a super accurate measurement of both masses. So if these guys exist, what do we know? We don't know. But if they exist and merge, then you could measure both masses with a multi-band instrument like this. And then I'll discuss something else that is basically Franz's idea. So let me explain. So the idea is to, you know, JFK, ask not what LISA can do for LIGO, ask what LIGO can do for LISA. So suppose that I have one of these LIGO detections, and what I know is the merger time to an extremely accurate accuracy, right? So now I can go back to my LISA data, and in my LISA data we'll have a lot of glitches. And I can ask, does any of these triggers in LISA match the coalescence time of one of the events that I have seen in LIGO? Okay? When it does, well, bingo, maybe that was not a noise event, that was an actual low SNR detection. So what I can do is use this idea and imagine that this ball represents several triggers in LISA. The inner ball, so all of the events inside here have SNR greater than 2, Some of them in red are noise. Some of them in green I classify as actual detections because they pass a more stringent SNR threshold of, say, 8. But now, if I can play this game of looking at coincident detections in LIGO, I can lower my SNR threshold, and I can claim detection for a much larger number of events that would have otherwise been classified as triggers.
Would we really work with thousands of detection by ground-based instrument and thousands of glitches in ESA? It's not a big chance of actually catching something really random.
Well, yes, very good question. So in the end, that boils down to the sampling of your LISA data. And the sampling of your LISA data is such that you have about 10 to the 8 samples over the duration of the mission. So that's the answer to your question. It depends on the number of triggers that you have. If you believe, as we believe, that with a 3G detector, you're going to have 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 events, right? It probably still works. But yeah, it's a very good question.
So to follow up on that, there's going to be some uncertainty about the time to extrapolating that.
10 seconds.
10 seconds for every last event? I mean, surely it will depend on the nature.
10 seconds out of 10 years.
Yeah.
For a standard category of event, because if you have something which is barely detected, for example, in LIGO, then you perhaps expected greater uncertainty.
That was a histogram that I've shown you, and it was between 1 and 10 seconds. So it's a ballpark. I mean, in the end, what determines whether you can do you have a multi-dimensional space of parameters that you can determine with LISA, right? You can determine the coalescence time, you can determine the chirp mass, localization to within some accuracy. But what dramatically shrinks the size of the multi-parameter space you're sampling is the coalescence time. And that's this ratio of 10 seconds to the duration of the mission.
But I think the error in the coalescence time is going to be smaller with the sample spacing for LISA, right? So that's a worse limit.
But to do this, so suppose you have your event in whatever ground-based detector, right? So what do you assume for detection? Because there you get an estimate from, so you need an estimate for the chair mass and for the individual masses.
Which you get from the 3G detector. You get everything pretty much.
Yeah, but now what is that? Because the 10-second accuracy, the 10-second accuracy in the merger time is by assuming that you measure the signal LISA, where you get the estimate of the chirp mass with 10^-6 accuracy and the mass ratio of 10^-3, which you will never get.
There would be a bigger
error propagating back.
But I don't think this. Once again, the thing that cuts down the number of false alarms is the coalescence time. So if you know that the thing merges there, you determine the chirp mass with a 3G detector to an accuracy of 10^-3. Right. You know, what else do you want?
No, but you don't know that the thing merges there. I mean, you know that the thing merged, right?
What you do is you go back and you see if there was a trigger in LISA.
Like half an hour because that's how the estimate, that's how good is the estimate of the chirp mass and then the individual mass with your chip. You don't get back and you see if there is a trigger in that set in that matches within, you know.
I'm not sure.
One way to think about it maybe is you start at LISA, and for each trigger, you push it forward to LIGO, and you ask, was there an event in LIGO?
Right.
And you keep doing that, and the ones that are, then you select them. But then you can see.
But again, if the SNR in LISA was 2 or 3,
the fact that LIGO is so accurate is less useful. Mm-hmm.
Well, if you do that with LISA, though, what parameters do you use actually to propagate forward so that you find
that's the point, is that it's...
I think the concept of thing I don't understand. When you say about trigger within 10 seconds, what does that mean? Because if you take a merger in the ground base, you propagate it back. So you're looking there for a persistent signal in LISA that was there all the time, right?
So what we're taking in the case study, we're just taking a circular binary So there's a caveat that we don't know if a trigger in LIGO that corresponds to a circular binary, for example, would match, you know, when you go back. So this is a proof of principle idea that you can reduce the SNR threshold. So I agree that there's a lot of practical data analysis problems to be solved to actually implement it, okay? I'm not, but yeah. Do you want to ask?
Yeah, if I could ask the question this way. Could you use all the 3G detections to reconstruct the stochastic background or something like that in that Lisa observed
so,
years ago?
It's a very good question. To some extent, you can estimate. So what I know is this, that in one of the papers with Alberto, in fact, where we looked at the estimates of eccentricity in LISA, we looked at the magnitude of the stochastic background from binary black holes, and we estimated it using the rates from LIGO, and we found that it would be undetectable.
Yeah, it's got to be, right? I mean, white dwarfs,
yes.
With space domination, there's an overwhelmingly greater background of white dwarfs than anything else.
Sorry, can you repeat this?
So if you take the rates from LIGO,
yes.
And you ask the question, are GW1509, 14 like binaries producing a stochastic background that is detectable in LISA?
Yes.
What you find is that the typical magnitude of the stochastic background is below what would be detectable. I know that Satya is also.
So it's overwhelmed by the white dwarf. So any.
Yes.
Can I
Why?
Because it's not. Because it's detectable.
It's detectable?
Not the individual events which will be detectable, but the stochastic background is going to be overwhelmed by the extra galactic white dwarfs.
No, there's a galactic white dwarf is chopped off at 2 × 10⁻³.
The galactic white dwarfs are chopped off at 2 × 10⁻³. The extra galactic white dwarfs are not. They persist at a much higher frequency.
The extra galactic white dwarf.
And there's going to be a much larger number of them than there are going to be individual merit mergers of neutron stars and black holes. So then, like in Farmer and Finney, they actually have this, right? So the galactic contribution that dies off at 2 × 10⁻³,
right.
Thank God, otherwise we'd not be detecting Emery's.
Right.
But below that level, and probably still well above whatever you're getting from the universal collection of black holes and white dwarfs, is the much larger set of extragalactic white dwarfs, which rolls over at a lot higher frequency.
Did they make an estimate of the SNR to which you can detect
those? You're not detecting.
No, detected this.
The power
SNR of the stochastic factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they plot it in the figures.
It's not your question. Why does it roll over at a higher frequency?
Just because the reason that it rolls over in the case of you actually detect the individual ones after a while, and for the galactic set, since you only have 10^8. Then you roll over at a pace where you can start actually detecting and removing individual white dwarf binaries about 2 × 10⁻³ hertz.
So very rare, very close binaries.
Rarer, you're right. But now you add up all of the galaxies, and you can therefore go to a much higher frequency before you have less than 2 per frequency bin, which is the threshold at which you can start subtracting them out.
So can I move on and we?
Is this something that we should ask Still to talk about when we volunteered him to talk next?
We could just ask him to rap.
Who's going to be talking the week after?
Still.
Oh, Sterling's going to be here.
He doesn't know it yet, so perhaps he should be asked himself.
Can I move on for now? Yeah. So. We'd better be able to do this because if you look at rates from field binaries alone, remember, Chris, that when you said the numbers in the paper with Davide are pessimistic, we're only looking at the contribution of field binaries to the total rate of stellar origin black holes that we observe in LISA, okay? So those numbers are shown here. If you assume an SNR threshold of 8 or 4 and a mission duration of 4 years or 10 years, so the lower SNR threshold corresponds to being able to play the game that I was just discussing, where you lower the threshold by doing coincidence with ground-based detectors. SNR threshold of 8 corresponds to doing it blindly. And then you see that the numbers, depending on sigma, can go from, in 4 years, maybe a few. In 10 years, of course, you have more events, but it depends on whether you can fly the mission for that long and so on. So the numbers are here. Now, you can also ask what subset of the field binary population is observed by LISA. And this is not a shocking plot, but it shows you that preferentially you see the more massive systems, of course, SNR is higher. You see systems that are close by, of course, because SNR is higher. And you see systems with mass ratios comparable to unit. Now, one thing that would be very nice if we could do it is go to LISA and check whether these systems are eccentric or not. And I won't say much because I don't have much time and I want to get to the multi-generation stuff. But the point is, can you measure the eccentricity? Because if you can, the eccentricity distribution predicted by field binaries, there's a paper by Kowalska, Chris, and others that we took for these orange distributions, is very different from the distribution predicted by clusters. And it's very different from the distribution predictor if you have something like Kozai lead of resonances in a massive black hole. So you can see by eye that if I can measure the eccentricity for binaries that belong to these different distributions, I can probably do something interesting with them. And in fact, there is a paper that it's the same paper where we estimate the background. So in this paper, we have also the estimate of how accurately you can measure the eccentricity. And basically, we find that eccentricities of order 10 to the minus 2 and maybe even 10 to the minus 3 can be measured by LISA. If you go below that, you cannot measure anymore. And then you can use this to tell models apart as long as you have enough events. This is the punchline of this slide. Why is this relevant? Because there is very recent work by several people, including the Northwestern group, Johan Samsing and others, that estimated that, well, Cole has worked on this a lot also, I'll get back to this later, but they estimated that if you do Newtonian simulations, Newtonian and body simulations of how many eccentric events you should get in LISA, those are severely underestimated compared to the case where you include post-Newtonian effects in the dynamics. And the reasons for this are still probably unclear, but people are working on it. And the key message from this paper by Johan Samsing is that these very highly eccentric binaries that are measured by LISA merge in between hardening binary single interactions, and that's what makes them so eccentric in LISA. Okay. Now, the bad news, before I move on, the bad news at the end. There was a paper by Chris Moore and Davide where they said, well, okay, so far all of these estimates that we have made assume that we take a signal-to-noise ratio of 8 because that's what people do in LIGO. But was that assumption justified? And so they said, well, if I want to estimate the SNR threshold, typically that estimate is done by looking at the number of templates that I need to match my signal. And so they went ahead and they did a calculation similar to the one that people had done in the past for EMRIs. And they found that the most realistic SNR threshold that you probably need to detect these guys is between, let's say, 14 and 15, depending on what you assume. That's very bad news, because the number of events scales with the cube of the SNR. So if we had 1 to 10 with an SNR threshold of 8, this tells you that if you do much filtering to detect these guys, you're hopeless. You'll never see them in LISA. So what do? Either you come up with a more clever idea than doing coincident detection with LIGO, because even that doesn't save you here. Pushes you down to order unity events during the duration of the mission.
Can you explain the horizontal axis?
Yeah, that's the number of template banks that you need for a detection. Mm-hmm. They say 10 to the 40. So
these are comparable mass binaries.
This is something I don't understand.
This is a very long discussion that we should have offline, because I don't know if you want
to. 10, template, like with 10 to 40 templates in this, is, I mean, these things are over-covered by construction.
I can't believe it takes essentially as many template designers.
Yes, I'm also, I think this is overly pessimistic, honestly. But, you know, I don't want to look like I'm pushing for this source more than I should. And I think it's something that should be looked at very carefully. So I just want to put it out there. There's this archive preprint that says we'll probably see nothing. And we should think about whether this estimate is realistic. You know, these are people who know what they're doing.
The threshold of scenario 8 was essentially chosen. I mean, certainly this is a calculation. Mm-hmm. Was that for scenario 8? This was not the calculation. Mm-hmm. Thinking that, especially the one that do not merge within the lifetime of LISA, most of them they breathe a little bit in frequency. We just put out a paper with Manjari that essentially you are fine reconstructing them with the Peterson Matthews.
Yes.
And we can detect white dwarfs with SNR 7, why we need SNR 14 for those things.
Yeah.
And the template bank is going to be dense, like it's the low mass anyway. If you did a template search, which you probably shouldn't. I don't understand where this comes from.
Yeah.
This seems, if you can do it for the white dwarfs, you should be able to do it for the black holes.
I think there is an area where there's papers to write, and it's important to understand what kind of SNR threshold you need realistically and what kind of search technique you should use to go after these guys. So what this is telling you really is that match filtering is probably not going to work if you apply it blindly. Okay? But I'll leave it at that. Yes.
I'm not an expert on this, and I mean, there's something I just don't understand. So if you were to take just that calculation, but scale it down, let's say, to LIGO, do you still need to have a huge number of template banks? I'm just trying to understand what is it that requires essentially this very large number for LISA, but, you know, for LIGO.
The size of the template bank basically goes to a fairly large power of the low frequency cutoff because you get more cycles and take it extreme, you've got the pulsar case, right, where you have continuous wave signal with some mild modulation, you have to have these huge banks. That's why outside of home is so computation doesn't go somewhere like F to the minus 8/3 maybe. So the more cycles you have in band, these guys have a ton of cycles in band, they're probably one parameter family. It's just chirp mass. Mm-hmm. But you have so many cycles in band, you have a huge
discrimination
mass, you need a really dense temple bank. But I don't think this is the right way of doing it.
That's a good point. Yes. You extrapolate the continuous wave to say we need implementing it.
Yes. In fact, Case, my student, had an extensive email exchange exactly on this point with David and Chris Moore. But there's another thing also I should point out. In the estimates that we made to lower the threshold, the key element was the false alarm rate for low SNR events in LISA. And we don't know that. And the reason we don't know that is that we haven't done LISA data challenges for this particular source class. And so what we used was the false alarm rate that Duncan, I know, discussed 1 or 2 weeks ago. And we took power laws that were supposed to mimic the false alarm rate in LIGO. And we said, well, maybe this is not actually going to work when the SNR is below 5 or so. And then we took optimistic and pessimistic extrapolations of what is known from LIGO to estimate how much you can lower the SNR threshold in LISA. The truth is we know very little about how to get the signals out of the noise, and there's a lot of work done if people think they're worth digging out the noise. And I'm arguing that there is physics to get out of this, because if you measure any amount of eccentricity, even for a subclass of those events, you're going to learn a lot. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, no, I saw that you were changing, going to the mid-band depth. So before, just to add a couple of points here. First of all, about the background. So yeah, I mean, I will check in the numbers with, so, My statement was that the background is detectable if you assume the LISA noise. Okay, if you have the LISA sensitivity curve and you integrate for 1, 2, 4 years, then you see the background. You see the
from black hole stellar mass.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The thing is that it's buried in the white dwarf extragalactic binaries, and the estimate there is, yeah, it's probably a couple, yeah, factor of 2-3 higher, probably.
I remember.
Still depends on the, you know, how the rate given by light turned out to be. And the other interesting thing here is that the white dwarf binary at background is dropping at, you know, essentially 10 to the minus 2 Hertz because they merge. Whereas if you have neutron star and black holes, it continues as F to the minus 2/3, and you know, if you can get some spectral information and that frequency range, you might get some sound.
Now, in terms of the double black hole, yeah, is this going to be a genuine stochastic background? In this case, you're going to have several of them per frequency bin, or will they be individually distinguishable?
It's going to be dominated, I would guess, by those events that Emmanuel was talking about, the events that are sub-threshold.
Right.
So it's going to be very, you know, popcorn-ish.
Yes.
From the popcorn-ish, I think.
Okay.
And the other thing that I wanted to remark is that all these estimates about the multi-band number of events, they are extremely sensitive to the existence of a very stability gap and to the location of that. Because if you make the same calculation, if you just assume like a power law, okay, and you make the same calculation by allowing black holes extending to mass 60 solar masses, you get a factor of 3-4 more events.
I agree with you so much that 2 minutes ago I told Chris, notice that the estimates in the paper with David, they were based only on taking your simulations, which have a mass gap, and so they are pessimistic. And now I'm transitioning to, why don't we build mid-band detectors if I had 10 minutes? And what happens if you have multiple generation? And there is a reason I organized the talk like this. So I agree with you completely. All right. Yes.
Crable throws out 15 minutes.
Can I move really quickly? Sorry, Franz, can you ask me later? Okay, so mid-band detectors. Now, all the trouble comes from the fact that you have LISA up here, and you're really trying to measure a signal that is barely above the noise curve. But if you had a disigo here, all of my troubles would go away and I would sleep much better. Okay, the problem is I don't have it. All right, so I asked, now, one thing that you may want to do with these signals is go after electromagnetic counterparts, because if you can detect them with a mid-band detector or with a low-frequency detector, then you can go after counterparts. So we were discussing these things in a group meeting at Johns Hopkins, and Mark Amiemkowski was like, have you guys thought about neutron star black hole? And I had not. And so Case, my student, is a machine, and so I told him, why don't you look at this? And so what he did was, he said, no way, this is a waste of time. So I felt like the bad advisor that gives bad projects to a student. And I asked him, okay, why don't you ask the following question? Take the high frequency noise of LISA and bring it down by a factor. I don't know how to do it because I'm not an instrumentalist. Mm-hmm. And ask the question, what kind of factor do I need to get neutron star black hole rates that make sense? And this is the result of the calculation. We didn't publish, so don't scoop us, please. I asked Case if I could show this, and he said yes. So we take a 1.4 solar, I take a 1.4 solar mass neutron star and a black hole of mass 5, 10, 30. I don't go much above that because if the black hole is too massive, it will never produce an electromagnetic counterpart, and so I don't really care about it anymore, because it doesn't buy me very much, right? So there may be black holes more massive than 30, but I don't know. So what I do now is I take these thresholds and I ask for how often could I have events with which are detectable, for which I can determine the coalescence time and localize them, or only detect them and determine the coalescence time, or only detect them. These are the different line styles here. And the number on the x-axis is the improvement factor. How much do I need to improve the Lisa noise curve to start seeing something? And this is one event. So you see that I need to improve it by almost a factor of 10 to the 2, which honestly, even for a theorist. But things are much better if you have something like this IGO. I don't need to improve it. In fact, I can make it pretty damn worse than what it is, and I will still see them. Okay, so that's the message here. A midband detector could do a lot of things if you're looking for stuff like this. And there's not just this IGO. Surjit Rajendran recently joined us at JHU and has been working on using atom interferometry to go after mid-band signals. And there's an Astro 2020 white paper on this, and I could spend some time on this, but I don't have it, so I won't say much.
What's the turnover in that block?
What do you mean?
So those are F to minus 7/3.
I asked the same question.
Okay.
Yes.
I can tell you what that is.
Okay.
I'm curious to hear. Okay. We should keep in mind that there's people. This is an archive preprint from last week about stellar interferometry to go between pulsar timing arrays and LISA. Who knows? Well, but, you know, I think we should start thinking about what kind of astrophysics you could do if you had detectors in between. That's the message. Okay, let me go to this. How much time do I have, Duncan?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay, 10 minutes. Let me explain the key idea. The key idea here is, okay, we have seen pretty massive guys in LIGO. Chris told me, okay, it's just, they're low metallicity events. It's fine, we can produce them in the field. But you can ask the question, okay, maybe these are high mass guys because they were produced through repeated rounds of mergers. So is this something that you can do? And if you can do it, what kind of signatures do you expect to see in LIGO that would tell them apart from very massive guys that were just formed at high metallicity through field formation? So that's the key question. There's a paper also by Dan and Maya that appeared about the same time. So let me explain. Here what I show is the distribution of flat log power law means that we take three different assumptions on the mass distribution of 1G events from the LIGO papers. Those of you who have read the LIGO papers know what it is. If you don't, that doesn't matter. So, but the point is, you start with some mass distribution for your 1G events, and then you let them merge again. And you ask, how is the distribution in mass, mass ratio, redshift, and effective spin going to change when I go from first generation event to merger of a first generation event with a second generation, and then I merge them again to G plus 2G. Notice that there's lots of tongue-in-cheek jokes because this paper came out soon after a certain presidential election, but okay. Now, the point is, when you have multiple generation events or second generation guys in there, the mass distribution, as you would expect, tends to go towards higher masses, right? If you merge again, you're going to produce heavier black holes. It tends to go towards mass ratio 1, which is something that the dynamical people have known for a while. And, of course, you tend to see events that are preferentially at lower redshift. That's because it takes time to merge multiple times. So when you see these multiple mergers, they will merge closer to you, right? So basically the idea was, and also key, this goes back to a paper with Marta that we wrote when we were kids. When you take black holes and you merge them, typically you get a final spin that is of order 0.7. Even if the spins are aligned and isotropic, you tend to cluster there. There's good reasons why.
So why did spin, I think the spin didn't change? Could it go back one plot? I mean, one spin? Yeah, the last. Yeah.
Chi effective.
Why did it didn't change?
Because these are all isotropic.
Still
Everything is isotropic.
Okay, let's say, but you know, okay.
chi effect, it doesn't tell you much. That's what I've been saying from the very beginning. But the two spins, one of the two black holes will be preferentially spinning.
So
but
it emerges all, it's all dynamical. It's all dynamical.
Yeah, it's all dynamical.
Okay, sorry.
It's all dynamical.
What you're getting is now you get Spencer points out.
Yes, yeah. Yes, correct.
Otherwise. Yeah.
So, but the spin, individual black hole spins, is going to cluster around 0.7. Okay.
So you're fixing the magnitude, but still just isotropic.
Yeah, we start with non-spinning, and then we ask, okay, what's going to happen? Suppose, to be conservative, if they were non-spinning, they're going to cluster around 0.7, but everything is always isotropic, so chi effective is always at zero.
Well, if you start at zero, why do you have a first generation not exactly zero, chi effective being zero? If you start with spins, spin magnitude zero, why the blue line is not exactly zero?
What do you mean? It's always centered at zero.
No, it's centered, but I'm saying if the magnitudes, if you start with two black holes...
It's a distribution. They're merging isotropically, so chi effective sometimes is
positive. No, if magnitude starts at zero, if they have no spins, chi effective should be zero.
I don't know, actually, here, maybe.
So you want to be the
spin. Yeah, I forgot.
Yes, probably. Exactly. Not zero, but
maybe for this plot they were uniform from zero to one.
Because otherwise it would be exactly zero.
Yeah. Right. I bet in this plot they were uniform zero to one. Yeah, you're right. But in this, so what did we take in this plot? It's uniform from zero to one. There you go.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you. Okay, so they're uniform from zero to one, and after the first random merger, they're picked around 0.7. Okay, so, but basically the question is, yes.
So what's chi1, chi2? Oh, sorry.
Individual spins and final spin. So these are, it's just to show that if you start with a distribution that is uniform, after the first round of mergers, it's not going to be uniform anymore.
Yeah.
So, okay, that will be useful for the last 5 minutes of my talk if I get there. So, can you use these distributions to tell 1G, 1G from 1G plus 2G and 2G plus 2G? We tried to compare by using a simple odds ratio calculation against the, at the time, very few LIGO events that we had, and we found not conclusive evidence that they are preferentially 1G plus 1G. But we couldn't really tell because we had too few events. But we show that the odds ratio is going to improve, and you will definitely be able to tell when you have of the order of about 100 events. Okay? Now, last topic here, which is the paper that we just put out. Suppose now that LIGO were to see something at masses larger than 50 solar masses for the component black holes. What could you learn? If you assume that the mass gap, first of all, exists, and second, that it is filled by multiple generation mergers of the kind I've been discussing now. There are other ways that you can fill the mass gap. After we put our paper out, we got emails from people who said, oh, AGN disks, oh, this, oh, that. Okay, there's other ways that you can do it. But suppose that you fill the mass gap by multiple generation mergers. So what we did in this paper was we said, okay, let's suppose that the first generation mergers follow a power law, and basically follows the standard star formation rate. Let's assume that the spins are uniform in some range. The parameter is chi max. How large can that range be? And then, following a paper that Dan put out from Maya, we said, well, let's suppose either that these black holes pair completely randomly or that they pair preferentially at comparable masses. And there's something to say there, but anyway. Let's assume, to be conservative, that selective pairing is what happens because that's what the data favor. And then you can ask, how many of your black holes would leak into the mass gap because of repeated mergers? That depends on the escape velocity of the astrophysical environment in which you are, because let me state, there's only relativistic recoils at play here. There is no astrophysics. The escape velocity is constant. It shouldn't be. We're just taking random pairs, merging them together, and asking, because of the relativistic recoil, is the second generation event going to stay in the cluster, or is it going to be kicked out? If it's going to be kicked out, we don't consider it. If it stays in the cluster, it can merge again. That's all the nature of the game here. And what we get is that depending on the value of the escape velocity that you get, you find a different distribution for the events in the mass gap. If your escape velocity is too small, you kick all the black holes out and you don't feel the mass gap. And if it's larger, you can retain black holes and merge them more than once. Now the question is, what kind of multiple generations, sons of immigrants, end up merging again, right? So, well, the numbers are here, that maybe 30% of the total number of events in the gap are going to come from 1G plus 2G. And so this is the contribution to the total rate in LIGO. And this is the contribution that comes from 1G plus 2G to G plus 2G and larger than third generation events. Under the assumption in this case that that you have a chi max of 0.5. And the chi effective is here on the right, but because everything is isotropic, it's not very informal, it doesn't tell you much. So what is the key here? The key is chi max, because if you reduce chi max a lot, then what happens is that you end up having a distribution of recoil speeds that is bimodal. Because when chi max is exactly equal to zero, your recoil is going to be, for those of you who are not relativists, it can be, it has a distribution that goes like this. It's zero at mass ratio zero. It peaks at a mass ratio of about one third, and it's equal to, now I forgot the number because I'm getting old, but 200 something kilometers per second. And then it goes to zero at mass ratio equal to one, okay? So the best you can do with non-spinning black holes is a kick of order, here it is, a few hundred kilometers per second. But then if you have spinning black holes, the recoil can be much larger and it can be of order thousands. So whenever your chi max is different from exactly zero, you kill this little bump down here and most of your recoils are going to be very large. And you're going to kick out a very large fraction of the black holes. Then you can ask the question, what is the probability of having second generation mergers that are retained in the cluster and contribute to LIGO rates? And that's what I'm showing you here. So, like I said, chi max equals zero is an anomaly. You get a very abnormal fraction of events in the gap because you're, yes?
Are these cluster events, fractions?
So this is fraction, this is the probability of having an event in the gap.
From the cluster population?
Yes, from the cluster population. So depending on chi max, assuming selective pairing, you see that it's very unlikely to get a significant probability of black holes being in the gap if the escape velocity is larger than about 50 kilometers per second. And if you do not assume selective pairing, you get tighter bounds, actually. So selective pairing is conservative. Another thing that is conservative, I'll say it again, is that we only have relativistic recoils. So if you have other ways of producing the recoils, you're going to get a larger probability of ejection. Right. So these numbers, basically, we can quite confidently state, based on this super idealized toy model, that if you see events in the mass gap and you believe that they are coming from repeated mergers, then the recoil velocity of the environment should be larger than about 50 kilometers per second, which means that globular clusters start having trouble if you look at plots like this. There, I'm sure there's more updated versions, but Dan is here and he's very familiar with this plot. This is the typical escape velocity from clusters. And if you have something of order 50, you're about here. And you start getting in trouble with explaining these things with globular matter.
And like you said, it's an upper limit because those dense clusters that produce second, third generation matrices, a lot of black hole interactions, and they kick each other out.
Yes.
It's not only the kick that you consider.
Yes. It's a dynamical kick.
Dynamical kick of global
matter. Yes.
Yes. But there's a lot of clusters, Nova, Nupla clusters, which have
Yeah, and
Cool, I got to the end. Okay, now we can discuss.
Can you return to the slide where you give the probabilities of second generic? Okay. Here, there is something I really do not understand.
Yeah.
So suppose I'm really concerned and interested in an event which is a 2G plus 2G, okay? So you are in a cluster where you had a merger between two, say, black holes that have a mass, say, below the mass gap, so say 40.
Yes.
So you produced a binary of 80 solar masses.
Yes.
Okay. Certainly you have some recoil.
Yes.
Let's say 200. And if it is in a cluster or environment with an escape velocity which is larger, this binary will probably be sort of kicked out from the center, but after some mass aggregation is going down into the core.
Yes.
Then you have to take into account, so you need to be in a, in an environment when there was also another 2G, 1G event, which was which is associated to very massive black holes to produce again a binary of 80 solar masses, which is also kept slightly away from the cluster center, so it has to return, so you have to wait for mass aggregation time. And then, since these are two independent
we don't have events, any mass aggregation time, let me interrupt.
Then you would like have them to bind in a binary.
Yes.
Through some dynamical process, which is either a three-body encounter with a third black hole, which we know is scaling with the velocity dispersion to the ninth power. So you are living in a high sigma environment. The high sigma environment is also a dense environment because the sigma larger is also implying a very large density. But then really you need to create a miracle that the 2G events that were kicked off and returning back see each other and not the other population of black holes which is there. So I find it that the 11% probability could really go down by a considerable factor.
But if I could follow up on that, the sigma to the ninth is for three-body binary formation.
Okay.
But if you have a lot of primordial binaries, you can have multiple swaps.
Yes,
I think will increase the probability rather dramatically compared to the last
two. Yes, I agree.
You still have to go through a number of intermediate steps,
yes.
But I think that makes it a bit more optimistic.
You need a lot of binary black holes in binaries with another star to let them bind in a way, because one 2G black hole has to exchange of a binary, and then in any case to find the other 2G black
hole. But you always keep finding the most massive ones, so
yes.
It's also preferential.
But it takes a lot of time.
Yeah, and people take almost the fact that you talk about in Monte Carlo calls, in global factor simulations, they do, like let's say, Emmanuel doesn't make segregation, but people do segregation, they have primordial binaries, and the fractions, I don't know the exact fraction in those Monte Carlo simulations, but they're not zero. They're lower than zero, I believe.
The Rodriguez et al. Paper, there was one Rodriguez et al. Paper where I believe that the spins were taken to be very low. There's a paper by Rodriguez et al. Where they have multiple generation binaries produced through embodied simulations.
And then you need very low spins.
Right.
But they have all the means at least to follow all those computations with any spins they want.
No, but I think that the 11% of the 2G plus 2G is really very, very
unrealistic. You can say it. I'm not claiming realism.
So we're wondering, like, if the 1G black hole performed at low spins to begin, initially the 1G plus 1G will be differentially comparable mass.
Yes.
And then the kicks are going to be very low. So at least that first stage, they're not going to get very far from the central flow, if that's the case. So I think that helps cut down the time scale a little bit.
Yes, but it is also the fact that you probably have that most of these binaries can get also a dynamical recall while they're forming. So most of, especially in globular clusters, you expect that most of the mergers are occurring outside globular clusters. Instead, maybe in nuclear cluster, this is not the case. So if you produce them in globular cluster, they are ejected and then they are alone, lonely, and they merge. If you are in a star cluster, nuclear star cluster, very dense, then everything is going to help. And so maybe the 2G, the only place we are aware of in the local universe are dense nuclear star clusters.
I'm going to give Monica the last word here because we do have to leave the room.
By the way, Carla just sent me the title of his talk, which is Black Holes, the Next Generation.
Okay.
Thank you, Monica.
More about that.